You know, we all have a lot of data, and it has to positively, absolutely stay safe.
It can't get into the wrong hands, and the biggest challenge we have is how to transfer it from here to there. We all know as leaders that legacy tools that transfer our important files and sensitive data are mostly outdated and fall short on security, especially with the demands of today's remote workforce. Relying on outdated technology puts our organization's brand at risk, and that is unacceptable. So we are excited to invite you to step into the future of completely secured managed file transfer from our friends at Kiteworks. Kiteworks is absolutely, positively the most secure managed file platform on the market today. They've been FedRAMP moderate authorized by the Department of Defense since 2017. And unlike traditional legacy systems with limited functionality, Kiteworks has unmatched software security with ongoing bounty programs and regular pen testing to minimize vulnerabilities. And the coolest part, they have easy to use one-click appliance updates you will love. Step into the future of secure managed file transfer with Kiteworks. Visit kiteworks.com to get started. That's kiteworks.com to get started today. And now, the show.
Hey, Cybercrime Junkies. This is your host, David Morrow. Today's episode, we're going to be discussing LockBit. We're going to talk about new lessons that we've gleaned and an expert analysis with our special guest, John DiMaggio. If you're unfamiliar with John DiMaggio, you should really look into him. He is the chief security strategist for Analyst One. You can check them out on their website. He is also the author of this book, The Art of Cyber Warfare, published by No Starch Press. And it is a phenomenal book, broken up basically into two parts, one more technical and methodical with lots of research and data, and then the other more of a high-level overview of the current state of cyber warfare and cybercrime as it exists. Breaks down the different cyber gangs and all the elements, which really gives great insight into ways that we can keep ourselves, our families, and our organization's brands safe when online. John's research is relied on, as well as others at Analyst One, by federal law enforcement. It's led to tons of indictments as well as assisted in investigations involving nation state attacks. John was actually one of the foremost experts in nation state attacks, and he was involved in identifying the very first ransomware cybercrime gang, which was called Blackvine. He's aided law enforcement, like I mentioned, and he's been a regular contributor to leading national magazines and news articles such as, you know, the New York Times, Wall Street Journal, Bloomberg, Fox, CNN, Reuters, and Wired Magazine. He speaks regularly at leading security events like RSA and Black Hat. So on today's menu, what we're going to serve is a deep and great discussion about the evolution of LockBit, right? There's LockBit Original, then LockBit 2.0, LockBit 3.0, and they evolve regularly, and they are ruthless. They are absolutely one of the most prolific and dangerous cybercrime gangs on the face of the planet today. And we're also going to have a side of a little discussion on our evil, which was one of the foremost, the previous leaders in ransomware, because they were one of the very first ransomware as a service groups. And for those not very technical, this stuff will really make sense because the way that we discuss it, the way that we socialize this and explain it, it's all in regular English. It's all in regular layman's terms. So as always, thank you for listening. We appreciate your downloads of our episodes, attendance, and questions at the live streams. We appreciate all you guys do. We couldn't do it without you. And we thank you so much. And now the show.
Lucky to work for a great group of people you really believe in.
Find yourself making an impact.
Technology is a river that flows through every aspect of an organization, and today is different. We put ourselves and our organizations literally at risk of complete destruction every single time we get online. One click, one distraction. is all it takes. Hi, Cybercrime Junkies. This is your host, David Morrow, along with co-host Mark Mosher.
Come join us as we explore our research into these blockbuster true crime stories,
along with interviews of leaders who built and protect great brands. John, welcome to the studio.
Thank you. Thanks for having me. I'm really excited to be here, guys.
Yeah, we're really excited that you've taken time so we can have this conversation. For those who don't know, I see a lot of posts on LinkedIn and other forms of social media, a lot of articles out there about this book. Okay, John wrote this book, and I'm telling you, it is fantastic. And I have so many questions, but we're not gonna spend all day asking you about this. But for those that don't know the book, it's The Art of Cyber Warfare. It's an investigator's guide to espionage, ransomware, and organized cybercrime. And just a couple questions, John. I mean, what drove you to create this book?
Yeah, so I promise I won't go down a too deep dark of a rabbit hole here, but I started my career as an engineer, and that I sort of drifted towards security, and I was doing security assessments, and what I found when you do security assessments is if you can talk about those things and you can write about those things, you can speed up your career advancement much quicker. So I started to do that. Well, in that process, I learned that I really liked to write, which was astonishing, because if you were to look at my high school GPA, you would never know that. But it just became like a passion of mine. I really enjoyed doing it. So I didn't go to college until I was 30. So when I went back to get my degree, cool, and I started doing like a lot of these long-term research projects and things like that, I really got into it. And what I found was, once I finished college, I was just like, I want to keep doing this. And eventually I got recruited to go work for a government intelligence agency. They trained me how to be an intelligence analyst. I already had the technical engineering background. But what I found for a hobby is I just started going out and looking for stuff and then writing about it. And I stood up my own website and things like that. Well, government agencies don't always talk with one another. I had one agency that thought I was maybe using my access to better my career because of the public blogging. So they showed up to work. My employer was like, no, he's got approval for all of this. We're good. But my point in sharing that part of the story is I realized, if they were showing up at my door and that part of my job to get approved to go public, it had to all be, open source information and stuff that I found on my own. I realized I must be onto something. So I was like, okay, I like to write. I like to do this. I want to do it outside of my day job. When I was at Symantec, I specialized in lots of espionage and nation state attacks. And sometimes they let me write and sometimes they didn't, because I like to write, a lot. I like to get really down in the weeds. I don't necessarily enjoy doing as much as the brief one pager blogs. I do those because I know there's readers that like that. But the point of this all is I wanted to write. So I went on an endeavor to write a book. And, I got knocked down a bunch of times. I think I had three different times where I had a book contract with other people where it fell through for one reason or another, and decided I'm going to do this on my own. And a couple more years went by, and then I finally, I got that contract with No Starch, which to be honest, I hadn't applied with them because I didn't think I'd have a chance. They're, like top of the food chain, in my opinion, with technical books.
Yeah, they're
books.
Phenomenal publishers. Yeah. And they opened the door for you to
they did. I was shocked. So many rejections, It was that every Sunday I would dedicate 3 hours. I would just put together publishing nomination packages, and every publisher is a little different what they want. Some are really easy, some are in depth. So after years of rejection, when I got that call back, I was really excited. And while I didn't know it at the time, getting the contract was actually not the hard part. The hard part then was actually doing the work, because once you have a contract, you have to be able to turn in deliverables. So now you're having to have a lot of dedication to do your day job, come home, spend time with your family, they're going to sleep, and you're getting on a computer to work for another 3 hours, until the midnight hours. So, but it was worth it. I loved writing. I love the book. I'm so proud of the work from the book. As of last week, it's been nominated down to the final seven for SANS Book of the Year through their Difference Maker Award for 2022.
Had my vote. I voted in that.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
I voted for you twice.
Absolutely.
Mark, thank you.
He was driving through Chicago and he was like, well, everybody votes twice here.
So yeah, right. It was not a problem.
What I really like about the book is you don't have to be technical. It's really divided into two parts, right? The second part is more, it's a deeper dive for those kind of in the field. But the first part is story after story about it really has like synopsis of some of the things that we all see in the news and how it relates. And I don't want to give away the nuggets that are in the book, but what I loved was just things behind some of these major data breaches and how they're actually tied to nation states. And nation states don't just attack other nation states. I mean, I think that was one of the initial takeaways. Most people think nation states go, it's just government against government. We're not involved. No, like they're going after private industry to do things like to find out who the spies are in the U.S., right? To find out who works for the CIA. And they correlate the data that they steal in these data breaches with other information.
Yep.
And that's really scary. Yeah. That is really scary for the average American, like the average person in North America to see some of this stuff. Like it was really shocking. I mean, it was a really good analysis. And I appreciate the fact that you still do those micro blogs, like the posts and the small things, because there's so much information out there. People don't have a lot of time and it's important to get out there. But for those that really want to find out the reasons why you're coming to a conclusion in a short post, then you've got some of your other research.
Stay with us. We'll be right back.
You know, we all have a lot of data, and it has to positively, absolutely stay safe.
It can't get into the wrong hands, and the biggest challenge we have is how to transfer it from here to there. We all know as leaders that legacy tools that transfer our important files and sensitive data are mostly outdated and fall short on security, especially with the demands of today's remote workforce. Relying on outdated technology puts our organization's brand at risk, and that is unacceptable. So we're excited to invite you to step into the future of completely secured managed file transfer from our friends at Kiteworks. Kiteworks is absolutely, positively the most secure managed file platform on the market today. They've been FedRAMP moderate authorized by the Department of Defense since 2017. And unlike traditional legacy systems with limited functionality, Kiteworks has unmatched software security with ongoing bounty programs and regular pen testing to minimize vulnerabilities. And the coolest part, they have easy to use one-click appliance updates you will love. Step into the future of secure managed file transfer with Kiteworks. Visit kiteworks.com to get started. That's kiteworks.com to get started today. And now the show.
Yeah, well, you know, one of the things that I try and do is I like to tell the story, you know. I mean, I do this work because I have a passion for it. You know, like I said, I did the book for a side project for fun. I did the blogs for fun. And now, you know, everything I write through Analyst One, it's all for the public. So it's all publicly available. There's you know, no sales gimmicks in or anything like that. It's just straight research. They let me publish it. They let me do my thing. But one of the things that's important to me is to make it so that, you know, you don't have to be the most technical person in the world. I want to tell you the story. I want to make it interesting. And I write for analysts. So also, you know, when my long in depth reports, they might be 50, 60 pages. And I do probably three of those a year. And those are for analysts. And then I do much shorter content where, you know, I try to get something really interesting and focus on it and do a shorter blog or shorter piece for people that might enjoy that. But I really strive to, and that's a lot of the feedback I get, you know, sort of confirms that, you know, I really strive to tell an interesting story and to not make it so in the weeds that, you know, you have to have an engineering degree to understand it.
Yeah, exactly. Right. That's why I really like that about the first part, right? The second part of the book, I geeked out in it. Like I really enjoyed the technical aspects, but in the first part, you had good arcs about a lot of the things that have been in the news. You know, our very first live stream on this platform talked about the Sony data breach, and you have a whole thing on it. Like, it's a good arc. You've got that. And then if you want to go deeper, there's all the research behind it. So really, really phenomenal things. So a couple questions I had just in general for our discussion today. For people that aren't in technology, right? Can you just walk us through the difference between nation state attackers? When we use that phrase, explain that versus regular data breaches, like the kids in Lapsus and the SimSwap crypto hackers, right? Like walk us through some of that and some of the unique characteristics of that.
Yeah, well, you know, that, why don't we just use the example that you started out with, you know, with the Anthem breach, you know.
Yeah, so tell the listeners what happened in that breach.
Sure. So in the Anthem breach, at face value, that breach alone, what happened was Anthem got compromised and a bunch of medical records and data were stolen and exfiltrated. Mm-hmm. Well, that turned out to be attributed to the Chinese government. And we wouldn't be able to validate that for a few years. But eventually, 2016 or 2018, I don't remember which, an indictment came out confirming that, naming names. Well, when that actually happened, you know, I was working that. And what here's sort of the difference of what you'll get between a traditional cybercrime incident versus a nation state attacker. If this had been a traditional cybercrime incident, that Anthem breach would have been it. That data would have been stolen. Those patient records have probably been sold. They would have been used.
It just would have been monetized, really, right?
Right. Yeah,
like they just would have sold it on the dark web.
Mm-hmm. But here's the difference. With espionage, you cannot look at one incident. It wouldn't make any sense. Okay. You got to look at the big picture. That's why you have to focus. You have to specialize in digging into that attacker. So in this example with Anthem, if you'd stopped there, you'd never know that it was an espionage attacker. But when you looked at what happened with that same organization, that was behind it by associating, you know, sort of building a digital fingerprint on them, the tactics that they used, any sort of human behaviors, anything unique, and you sort of overlay that against other attack data and you extract attacks that match that pattern, what you would have seen was the same attacker, the same adversary also attacked OPM, the Office of Personnel Management, which is the organization responsible for facilitating security clearance investigations for the United States. So you work for the CIA, you work for the NSA, you work for the FBI, whatever. Any organization requires
being right. Different layers of when you think of top secret information, right? There's different layers of people that get to see what is really going on.
And that information has everywhere you've lived, your relatives, if you've done drugs, all the bad stuff and the good stuff about you is going to be in there because they use that to make decisions on giving you access to very sensitive information. So this specific PLA organization also targeted OPM. So here's what happened. When you take the data from OPM, so when now we have a list of people that have clearances, and now when you go look at Anthem, you realize, at least at that time, Anthem was a healthcare provider for the federal government.
Federal government employee. Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. I worked for one of those intelligence organizations and they were my provider. And the point being, when you marry that data together, you take that list of people with clearances, you take now their healthcare data. And that's not even the whole story, but that you can start to picture the whole idea is to blackmail people. Okay. Whether you've had, think about it. I'm just going to be honest with you. Maybe you were, you know, you had problems with your marriage. Maybe somebody stepped out. Maybe you got an STD test or something. Whatever it is, all that is in your healthcare record. Now you have a history of doing.
Your file is permanently sealed, man. Don't worry. This is actually a surprise episode where we expose Mark.
Expunged. As far as I know, I'm an infant.
You're using an infant social security number for everything.
I've learned a lot on these episodes, right?
Sorry.
You're good. But that information married together is a weapon. And, you know, and there's other pieces of the story, but that's what's publicly known about it. But just those two pieces together, we can sort of show that pattern, how where with espionage, there's usually more than just two attacks in a campaign like that. And there is in this story too, but that's the public piece. But in those two, you can really see the example of how they're using that data, what they're doing it for, and what the long-term mission is, which is to come up with a list of information that can be used to blackmail, U.S. citizens that work for the government. So again, that's the difference. If cybercrime, you can do one breach at a time. I still do my work the same way. If it's an advanced attack, I try to look at the big picture. I'll take 6 months. I'll take a year. I'll look at everything. I'll try to marry all the parts together, build out the puzzle. Maybe I don't have all the pieces, but if I can get enough to see and think what that picture is, I can make a really good educated guess. So that's sort of the difference, is that longer term tracking, that bigger view from the sky is sort of necessary, that specialization and espionage to really focus. And our day-to-day defender is not going to do that. You know, that's the difference. Your day-to-day defender guarding a network, you're getting things left and right that you have to deal with and determine a false positive, true positive. Okay, we need to, shut this down.
They're busy searching for anomalies, and they're just trying to keep that brand secure, right? I mean, they don't have the time and the unlimited resources that it takes to actually tie, or the visibility, really, right? They're in a silo. Right. They know their organization. They don't get to see all of the different other, like this type of ransomware is designed or promulgated through certain crime families, right? And so they don't have time to go and research all the other things that crime family or group or syndicate would be doing to be able to tie that stuff together. So in your research, does it include like interviewing people, talking to them? Does it include access to things that most people don't have access to? What's your research model look like, just generally?
Yeah.
Without giving well, so the model's a little bit,
right. Yeah. The model's a little bit different for cybercrime. So I've really got into ransomware over the past several years. I've really focused and doubled down on that.
I think it's going to be big.
I feel like it's a waning fad, right? Yes. I feel like it's on its way down.
No, not so much.
I'd like for that to be true, but yeah, it's right, not true.
Right.
What got me to ransomware was the fact that they were taking tactics that were formerly only used by nation state attackers. And a lot of that's because with nation state attackers, you have the human on keyboard element. And before we really got into ransomware, that just wasn't the case. I mean, it was almost unheard of that you would have a criminal actor live on your network for anywhere from 7 to 21 days. Like that just didn't happen.
They really would just like either buy the ransomware and just launch it, right? Or they would create it.
Yeah, it was all automated. You clicked it, it worked. If you didn't, it didn't. But there wasn't a dude on the other end trying to get in to strategically place it throughout your environment and get privileges and take your data and turn off all your backups. You know, that's a lot bigger operation than just spamming somebody and hoping that they click on something that executes ransomware. Yeah. You know, completely different. One, an automated defense will stop. The other one, it won't. And that's really where the type of text that I spend my time on are the ones that have a human being behind it. And ransomware is where it really taken over with that. Briefly, just how I got into ransomware, I'll never forget it. It was May 12th. My boss said to me, "Hey, something's going on. We got ransomware alerts going off all over the world." I was at Symantec at the time. All over the world. "Can you take a look at this?" And I had only done nation state up to that time. And I was like, "Really? You want me to go look at ransomware?" It ended up being WannaCry. And let me tell you,
I'm putting
your foot in your mouth. I've not looked back since. You know, I've been full forward since, but that's why you can't ever just put something in a bucket, because you never know when it's going to change. But up to that point, you know, we hadn't had any.
What a launch pad that is.
Yeah. Yeah. So anyway, So following these groups, though, to answer your question, something that is different, that's very specific to ransomware that not everybody does. This is where my bread and butter, though. Fake personas, getting into various underground forums, listening to what these guys say, getting involved in some of the conversations, just extracting information. You know, I when I say I like to tell a good story, like I'm working right now on, this is one of my more analytical pieces, so it's going to be lengthy, but it's like a soap opera, like the back and forth that I have.
Oh, wow.
you know, and the screenshots and stuff with Lockbit and showing some of the things that they do. I was actually able to get access
to
Lockbit.
Apply to be like an affiliate. Were you able to apply to like be part of a game?
what's the vetting process to be an affiliate of Evil?
I did apply to be an affiliate with
them. Wow. I don't have the technical chops. They would see right through. Yeah. I'd be like, this is so cool. Like, and then they would bust me.
Well, no, here's the thing. You know, I know I'm not going to get, I'm only going to get so far.
Right.
You know, I know that, but anything I can learn is good. So I did the process when Art Evil was taking in new affiliates. I did go through the process. Yep. And, you know, the way that I'm not going to give too many things because this is my methodology, but I'll keep it high level. Absolutely. You know, I don't speak Russian, but to get around that, there are affiliates that, more affiliates are not in Russia than are. So, but as long as you can speak a language that's not English and that's in that element of the world, even if they don't speak it, what you do is, let's just say German, for example. Let's just say I start talking in German. Oh, I don't speak German. Well, we all spoke at least a little broken English because that's who we're going to target, our Americans. So that'll at least get me through part of it. And then from there, you know, you go through the interview and, you know, what they did in my case was they started asking questions about Russian folklore. And they were questions that you couldn't just get from Googling. So that's how they were able to weed me out. And I'm sure they did it with other people. And that's fine. But, I had about an hour and I got to learn what they do. They bring you into a talk channel and they'll talk to you. You'll talk to multiple people. You know, there's a lot of technical questions. There's a lot of questions on what you've worked in the past. And you need to be able to show that and prove that you've worked other because they want people with experience. They don't want somebody just learning. Right. So I knew I wasn't going to get through that whole process, but I wanted to learn as much as I could. So I did. So I do that every time I see an affiliate ad go up. I apply.
That's amazing.
Sometimes I'll actually reach out and as myself too, and just see if they'll talk to me as well.
I would think some of the groups are more prime. I mean, a lot of these groups like. Some of the groups that are out there that are doing certain types of tactics, right, are very boastful, right? They want a researcher to come in. They want to talk about it. They want to brag. There's a lot of bravado. Like we've seen it. And then some, they're really hard to crack. They're really hard to get them to even kind of come out of their shell at all. Are you seeing the same thing?
Yes. I feel like there are more that want to talk than don't, but yes, there are some that sort of have, a stronger OPSEC discipline and
they're proud of what they do. Like they're proud of what they do, right? They've been able to deconstruct something very complex. They want to tell everybody how they did it.
Yeah. The ones that are really proud want to tell everybody and those ones are more approachable. Lockbit and former Art Evil were probably the most approachable out of all of them.
For listeners, we've explained this in the past that today it's organized crime. And when you think of historic organized crime, some of these groups are very similar to some of the organized crime families, right? And some of them are making some of the same mistakes that some of those organized crime families did, right? When they talk openly or they're ostentatious about what they've done, it kind of reminds you of John Gotti.
Yeah, it's reminiscent of the Teflon Don, right?
To the guys that you're like, dude, like there is a process where you keep a low profile. Where you don't talk about it, where you don't get cocky and get in the news. And, you know, are you seeing some of the same thing with some of the cyber criminal groups?
Yeah. I mean, Lockbit's the perfect example of that John Gotti scenario, you know, put on your best suit and smile for the camera. I mean, whether that's good or bad, I'm not even judging them for doing it, but it's a good analogy because they want to be there. They're very approachable. They're willing to talk to the media. They will talk to some security researchers. But you know, their ego is so intense, and it's when you sort of look at their pattern of communication over the past 2 years, it has significantly increased. And, wow. you know, a lot of that is their success as they're getting bigger and bigger. They want their voice to be stronger and in the criminal community. So they're very vocal. And, you know, half the things they say aren't necessarily true. I mean, you can go back and they've claimed that they've operate out of the Netherlands. They've claimed that they, you know, reside in China. And I think the latest Lockbit actually said that he lived in the U.S., which obviously they probably don't live in any of those places. But I just find it amusing that they, one, that they put it out there, but two, that they forget. And they change depending on the interview. So,
so you've been doing a lot of research on Lockbit, and so we really want to explore that today. Before we start that, though, Lockbit was just in the news like last week about claiming that they had breached and exfiltrated all this data for Continental Auto over in Europe.
Yep.
And then they said, if you don't pay, we are going to release everything on Friday. And Friday came, and I can't find anything. Like,
so what does that mean?
Anything out there?
What does that mean?
Like,
so here's typically what I
guess about. What is your best educated guess about what that means? Does it mean that they were just bluffing, or does it mean that they paid the ransom? No. Like, what does it mean?
No. Okay, so they're definitely not bluffing. I've never seen Lockbit bluff. If they, I mean, they might exaggerate sometimes the how important the data or significant the data they have is, but they don't lie. They validate that they have the data. So I do believe if they say they have the data, they do have it. Now, they don't also don't all, well, they'll post on their auction site. Like if you look at the when they stole data from Entrust and threatened to release it, they did release it. They just released it on a different website. There was a form of a breach, and that's where they released that data. I haven't looked there honestly since Friday to see if that data is there or not. But if they say that they're going to release it, it is either being released, has been released. Or there's still some negotiation going on and they behind the scenes have given them a little more time, or like what you said, they've been paid. But if they get, you know, if they were paid, yeah, they wouldn't leak the data. But I don't think they would, because Continental went out and publicly said, which I applaud, because not many victims would do this, that they're not paying that ransom. Wow. And where I think that Lockbit overplayed their hand here was $60 million is a lot of money. And I think that, you know, I get they make their ransom based of the profit that an organization makes, but I think that you got to get more. I realize they're almost always willing to negotiate, and that's not what you're going to actually pay. But I just feel like their numbers keep getting higher and higher, and I feel like they're from a business model. Forget the criminal aspect; the business model, you're hurting yourself, because if you ask for smaller amounts, it's a higher likelihood that those places would pay. But you know that I was surprised. You know that was that high when I saw the dollar figure.
Yeah, we thought it's almost like they priced themselves out into the negotiations right from the beginning. You know, it's hard to go liquid $60 million just on the first talk.
Right.
Well, and even if you want to pay that, I mean, think about how difficult that is with regular, you know, monetary form of payment, let alone Bitcoin. I mean, it's just moving that kind of money is very difficult to do. Right. So that may be why we haven't seen, you know, a data dump yet is, like I said, maybe they think they're going to get paid. Or like I said, I haven't looked on some of those other forums. Maybe there's something out there. I'm sure it'll be reported soon, though, if it is.
That's so interesting. Okay, so let's shift gears to exploring some of your Lockbit findings. Let's start from the top. Kind of what is Lockbit? Can you just explain to people that maybe have not heard of it or have heard of it but they don't really know? Is it just a type of bad code that's ransomware, or is it a cybercrime gang, like an organized crime family? Is it both? Walk us through this.
So, let me talk about what they started as and what they grew to today. So they started as a lone gang. So it was not a RAS. So a RAS is ransomware as a service, and it's where you have a core gang that facilitates the ransomware, the services, the infrastructure, and then they partner with what's called affiliates. And they're the ones who take these resources and actually go and conduct the attack. And then everybody shares the profit and everybody's happy. Well, with Lockbit at the time when they started, it was just them as a gang. So they were doing all the work themselves. And they were using something called ABCD ransomware. And I'm going to assume that it was called that because that was what it put on the file after it encrypted it. It would right. that would post that extension to it. So they got that name. I don't think they liked the name because shortly after, within you know 6 months of operation, they changed it to append .lockbit to the end, and they put lockbit in the ransom note, and that's how they started being called lockbit. And then it was in 2020.
They couldn't get more creative than that. They couldn't like call themselves the Cobras.
They got like a bad marketing department. Or something.
You have to come up with something much marketing.
More cool. Yeah, something more creative than that.
You got what I call your video game based ransomware groups. You know, R Evil, right. named from Resident right. Evil, Vice Society. Yeah. You know, taking a step from Grand Theft Auto. So yeah, Lockbit went with lock and then bits. We're locking right. bits, and yeah, that's what they came up with. But you know, once they changed their name, it was shortly after in 2020, they opened up as a RAS service. And that was sort of the beginning of where they really started to expand. You know, early in that process.
For the listeners, John, I don't mean to interrupt, but for the listeners that don't understand what a RAS service is, I know we live in this world, but there's a lot of business owners and people that listen to these episodes. It stands for RAS. It's ransomware as a service, and it's really where an organization can create the actual ransomware, like something, some malicious code. They can handle certain aspects of the transaction. They'll create the decrypt keys. They might handle the customer service. They might handle some of the money laundering or the payment transfer, right? But then they hire all these affiliates that go, and they're the muscle. They actually go and execute on it, right?
That's right.
Okay. And then there's also another layer. There's a whole group of IABs, right? Which are initial access brokers. Have you found that IABs are involved in some of Lockbit's? So walk us through what IABs are, if you don't mind.
Yeah, so an initial access broker, IAB, it's a business in itself. So what those individuals do is they go out and they hack into corporate organizations. The bigger the target, you know, the more revenue they make, the better. And they're what's different about what they do is they have to be very stealthy because they're not stealing anything. They just want to get the access and hold the access. So they want to get in undetected and remain there. Once they have that access, they come back to these criminal forums, they market, advertise it, and they sell that access. So now an adversary just buys the access and walks right in, and they have now eliminated all the time and resources that are necessary to go and exploit it to begin with.
IABs, these initial access brokers, these could be people that they'll get access to a corporate network, a government agency or whatever, but then they don't necessarily want to get involved in extorting them or anything else. They'll just make a quick buck, a few grand on the dark web to just sell. Hey, I've got access to, you know, these 10 organizations. They buy it and then they make their quick buck. Okay.
And it's definitely invested also by just being an access broker. They're not the big fish. So, you know, there's
and so big government. Way they might. So they don't make themselves a massive target of law enforcement.
Exactly.
Right.
Exactly. Interesting.
Yes. Okay. And even law enforcement generally doesn't know they're there. Law enforcement doesn't even know they're there usually until after the fact when it comes out how the access was even obtained. So they're long gone by that point. You know?
Interesting. So ABCD ransomware becomes Lockbit. And then do we know where they're based out of? Is this a group mostly in the Eastern Bloc, Europe? Is this in Asia? What do we know generally?
Yeah, so the core group, my opinion, they're all from Russia. Personally, I believe they all still live in Russia. I mean, why wouldn't they? For the most part, you're secure there. You're not going to get arrested, especially now. So I believe that's where they still are. You know, there's been Lockbit, the actual leader of Lockbit has made claims that he's in other places, but he claims that they run their corporate network through, what is it, Starlink, Elon Musk's internet satellite provider or system. He's claimed, like I said earlier, that he lives in the U.S. He's claimed that he lives in the Netherlands. He's claimed that he lives in China. I think he lives in Russia. but you know, those are all the claims that he likes to make publicly. But you know, they all speak Russian. They're all originally from Russia. Now affiliates are something different. Affiliates, you know, if they're skilled, they've got the reputation and they're trusted. That's really what all that it takes to work for them. And they can be, you know, from all over the world.
Okay. Let me ask you this. You mentioned that from initial appearances that they may be in Russia, or, you know, it appears very much like that. And Dave and I and the team with speaking with some of our resources in Croatia, Dave, you know who I'm talking about, and one of our resources in the Ukraine, from what we understand about the operating out of Russia is you have to play nice with the nation. Like, you can't be in there and not. So does Lockbit's tactics and techniques reflect those of a nation state threat?
No, they, so there are groups, I wrote last year a paper called, Nation State Ransomware. And there are groups that certainly, appear to have ties to the Russian government. And then there's even groups whose malware has been repurposed or ransomware has been repurposed to collect information for espionage versus, you know, financial gain. Lockbit has, I have not seen any evidence that Lockbit is one of those groups that is affiliated with the Russian government. It doesn't mean that they're not. It just means that I haven't come across information to show that they are, you know, but generally, you know, speaking, these guys are out there to make money, and then they end up in a compromised situation where they then have to work and support the Russian government. But what they do, because they don't want to get arrested, so long as they don't attack, you know, a Russian entity, and, you know, they build it into their code to check to see, you know, the language being used and keyboard and all that great stuff. And if it's within the CIS, the former Russian Soviet Union, countries, they don't attack. So most of their attacks, though, are outside of that. So it's really not an issue, but that's just sort of a safeguard to make sure that they don't do something that's gonna get a knock at their door by the FSB. But we do know from multiple leaks, Conti leaks alluded to it, and then the TrickBot leak that came out had a lot more evidence that facilitates that kind of the premise that I had written about in my paper, you know, that these groups are affiliated in some way with the Russian government. Not all of them, but a handful of them, and they're leveraged to use for those purposes. And you see TrickBot being used in the Ukraine now for non-financial targeting. And, you know, it doesn't take a genius to figure out somebody knocked at their door and said, hey, you're going to come work for us now. And it doesn't mean that's all that they do, but it means that there is a portion of the work that they do that's, you know, that they're supporting the Russian government.
Sure. So as Lockbit developed as a, that was a good question, Mark. So as Lockbit develops as a RAS, a ransomware as a service model, what do we see in their evolution? Because there's like Lockbit 1.0, there's Lockbit 2.0, Lockbit 3.0. Kind of walk us through that arc, if you can. How has it evolved?
So when they first opened the doors, you know, they were far less mature than they are today. They had some issues in the beginning where their ransomware was only encrypting local files, and when it spread to network resources, it was not encrypting properly, and people were able to decrypt their data without the key, and a lot of affiliates got pissed because they weren't getting paid. They had to go fix that. So, you know, there were some bumps in the road, and that was sort of Lockbit version one. When in June of 2021, Lockbit 2.0 came out. But before that happened, Lockbit tried to join what I'm going to call a pretend cartel. We didn't know it was pretend at the time, but they joined with several other ransomware groups claiming to be a cartel. Now, the benefit of that would be larger entity, more power, more resources, and a lot more damage.
Sharing of resources among groups, sharing of tactics, and sharing of experience.
Yeah, they definitely knew these other groups, and they were working together. And again, I did a lot of research on that and wrote about that. But they were sharing resources. They were even sharing victim data and sharing infrastructure. But what they weren't doing is sharing money, and there wasn't any central leadership giving it direction. So it was more like, you know, I work with guys at different security companies all the time. Like, we talk, we collaborate, but we're not paying each
other. Right.
Each other. Working together. That still is very important to understand, but it wasn't a real cartel. So anyway, that happened in 2020. In June of 2021, they came out with LockBit 2.0. That was a game changer. The difference was with that, they made it so much easier and took out so much of the technical requirements necessary to facilitate ransomware attacks. They gave a really nice control panel where with lots of point and click buttons, you know, to facilitate the attack, to spread the ransomware, to look for password hashes, to break passwords, you could spread to just local hosts, like just the systems that the ransomware touches, or it could reach out across their network and try and infect that way. But everything was point and click. So that attracted a lot of affiliates. But there was multiple parts to this. So they came out with the ease of use software. They also changed their payment model. And this was the smartest thing that they have done compared to other ransomware gangs. Most ransomware gangs, and Revil was probably the most known for this, they hold all the money. Now, that's great if they do all the money laundering and everything else. That helps the affiliate not have to do it. But that means the affiliate has to trust them to be paid. Well, LockBit says, use our resources. You take the money and then you pay us. And the reason that really? Was so smart is
So interesting. Can you imagine organized crime families in the United States going, we won't hold the money. You take the money.
Right. You take the money. Cut.
Like that right. has never happened. That's an interesting. So that's LockBit 2.0. That's that version.
Yeah. Yes, okay. And that was such a smart thing to do because, yeah, you're going to get screwed by a small percentage are going to screw you and not pay you. But the volume of people that you're going to get, because now they don't got to be worried about getting screwed out of their money, you're more likely to
– players.
And Revil screwed so many affiliates out of their money and got caught that story alone, you know, sort of set the precedence mm-hmm. of – why it's in your why it's advantageous, you know, to you be the one that has the money and then pay the provider. So anyway, most ransomware gangs don't do that. LockBit does. And, you know, that is why one of the reasons they've gotten so many affiliates. The second okay. thing that they did is they went on sort of this smear campaign against other ransomware groups. So on these forums, you know, they started posting things. I'm just going to use Revil as the example. They started posting all this negative information about Revil, and then Revil would get pissed, and the two personas would go back and forth with each other, you know, on these forums. And it's great for, you know, for us getting on the information between the two, but for them, you know, they really wanted to smear Revil, who at the time was still at the top of the food chain, because they wanted their affiliates. And you can go back again. I like to look at big picture. I went through that whole year and I looked at all their, you know, just all the data that I had, all the communications that I saw. And they really had some very deliberate things that they did that when you put it all together, really made Revil look bad. And I think it was a very strategic move on their part long term, along with the release of their updated ransomware and their new business model, in order to move up to the top spot. Wow. You know, so that was
a long play to get a competitive edge for your competition. That's a business decision, visionary planning, strategic moves to get one over on the competition, which was our
it is. Attack. Wow. Most people don't realize that about LockBit. Like they're from a business perspective, they're much more strategic than they are tactical. They're smart about what they do and they think long term. But we look at them at short term. Oh, they did this attack today. They did this other. You know, we don't look long term. But that's sort of what this project I'm working on right now is doing. Look at them from a complete and total assessment, looking at everything from the human factor. I've really recently gotten into people. Not everybody believes in this, but with ransomware groups, you always have to talk to the attacker, whether it's during negotiation or whether you're an investigator on a forum. But you don't do that with espionage. With ransomware, you do. So if you know you're going to have to interact with the attacker, it only makes sense to add behavioral profiling to your threat profiles. And, you know, LockBit is a great example of that because there's so much human factor. These guys are doing interviews with the media. These guys are posting on the dark web. These guys are putting their comments out there, their opinions, not just on attacks, but on all sorts of things. So, you know, you can really gauge them and figure out what makes them tick. So that's sort of an element that I've added to what I do when I profile ransomware gangs now. But Revil is definitely, I mean, LockBit and Revil are one of the most interesting ones that are out there. But they still weren't, even when they released 2.0, when they did all this, they sort of got up into second, what I'm going to call the second spot. They still weren't number one. Conti was. is. Right. So as we came into 2022, you know, they really saw an opening when Conti posted that message right after the war started, saying that they were full support of the Russian government and forgot, I guess, that a lot of the affiliates they work with are in the Ukraine. Now you got some of the world's best hackers pissed off at you. You know, Lockbit saw that opportunity, you know, and posted the exact opposite message. You know, we're here, I'm paraphrasing, we're here for business. We're here to make money. We're apolitical. And, you know, they, again, very strategic. They really tried to set themselves up to move into that number one spot. So then fast forward to May of 2022, Conti is shutting down their operation. I mean, let's be honest, it won't go away, but they shut down that operation, which was huge. And, you know, Lockbit now is moving into first, and they released Lockbit 3.0, which, so take all the things I said about 2.0. Well, not only have they added more features, they've also addressed all the bugs and all the things that over the past year that didn't work with 2.0. And on top of that, you know, they have all these new bug bounty programs. They're accepting different types of currency. You know, they even had a tattoo competition. Like, again, they're from marketing perspective,
really?
They're interesting. Yeah. You have to send in a picture.
Wait, did you just say that Lockbit 3.0 like sponsored like events where they had a tattoo competition?
Wow. Yeah. So yeah, they were paying $1,500 or $1,000 per tattoo. You'd have to, you know, send in pictures and stuff, and it'd have to be look valid and everything that you actually got a Lockbit tattoo. I don't know. There's like 20 or so people that got it, but that I saw that were validated. I think there's a running list on GitHub somewhere. But from my perspective, like that's a good place to start looking at people. If I was law enforcement, if you like these guys enough to get a tattoo on you,
Is the competition still open?
I don't know if there's still going
on. Mark, you're not allowed. You're not allowed.
I can't get a Lockbit tattoo.
Even for
$1,000 is $1,000.
Yeah.
I'll tell you what, if you get a Lockbit tattoo, I'll give you $1,000.
Now it's on.
He'd be pulled over for something innocuous. They'll have a Lockbit tattoo. He gets taken to the feds. And he's like, I can't even code. I have no idea what
I have trouble logging on to my own laptop. What are you kidding me?
I just wanted to make $1,000 off of John DiMaggio, man. That's it. That's the only reason I got this.
$1,000, I'll get a John DiMaggio.
But you can see it's a whole marketing campaign, not just a ransomware.
So 3.0 improves the product, but then also wraps all these other PR and marketing aspects to it.
Yes.
So yes. And interesting.
They brought in their infrastructure. You know, just last week, or maybe it was the week before, they added a new piece. I don't know how public this is, but they added even a new piece to their infrastructure where they can use to send private encrypted notes now. They've made this like tool resource available and added a page to their
chat, like a new chat thing rather than using Telegram. They have a different one?
It's not so much for chat. It's like, for an example, let's say I want to give you a Bitcoin wallet. Well, now you can send an encrypted note versus doing it via chat or having to post it somewhere. And they added that to it's small, but I thought it's interesting because these guys, what's different about them is they always reinvest in their program. They constantly are trying to automate their malware or their ransomware. Oh, let's talk about their malware too, Steelbit. Mm-hmm. So everybody wants to steal information now. They created their own malware that their clients can use also through the same interface that the ransomware is controlled, point and click, to deploy Steelbit, which is used to steal and exfiltrate data. So you pick the file extension or you pick a directory you want to copy, whatever it might be. It goes, looks for it, finds it, and automatically exfiltrates it out. And you can either pick to send it to your server, or they have a handful of like Dropbox and other type of cloud-based storage services that you could send it to. But they make it as easy as possible. Literally, you know, you don't have to be a hacker anymore to work for Lockbit. You can do point and click. And I don't have any proof of this, but my belief is they're doing this, and they haven't done this yet, but they're doing this to eventually get to a point where they can rely less on affiliates. Not that they won't use them, but they won't need to pay them as much because they've made it so easy for them. Mm-hmm. that they don't have to spend near as much time doing it. Like, they were the first to automate their ransomware, and they, like I said, they constantly are building these new features and functions and, you know, supporting background. So yeah, they want to be the top ransomware gang. They're making it easier, but at the end of the day, if affiliates spend less time, they're probably eventually going to pay them less, but affiliates can still make more money, because what we're seeing right now, and the proof is in the pudding, with LockBit 3.0, there is more LockBit attacks than any other ransom group ever. You know, they're it's out of control, the volume of attacks we're seeing. That's because it's so easy now, and I think that's telling.
So it has LockBit. That is so interesting, and so it gets into the conversation that we talk to with business owners and leaders in government when we're meeting with them for other reasons, and that is, everything has changed with the ransomware as a service, because you no longer need to be that skilled engineer hacker, right? And the number of skilled engineer hackers, right, compared to the number of criminals out there that are willing to do that is there's exponentially more criminals. And it's part of the reason why we're seeing such an explosion in this. And the more they advance this with point click, automatic exfiltration, automatic, it's a fancy word for stealing of the data, uploading and removing the data. Have we seen the LockBit methodology to, have we seen things similar to what we saw with R-Evil? Meaning if they didn't engage in the chat, they would try and do a double or triple extortion, where they not only encrypted the data, exfiltrated the data, deleted the backups, but they might DDoS the group if they don't start negotiating with them. Is LockBit doing some of those same methods?
They are. And let's just take a step back. Remember when I said they worked with a cartel? Well, in that cartel was a group called Twisted Spider. They were behind the Maze operation. They were the first ones to start stealing data. A couple weeks after that, LockBit started. Suncrypt, another group that was in that alleged cartel, they were the first group to do a denial of service attack as another form of extortion. Today, fast forward a year and a half later, yes, we're seeing LockBit not just encrypt data. They've been stealing data, but now we saw it with Entrust, and there's a handful of others where they're also doing distributed denial of service attacks. So now a victim finds themselves, their systems are encrypted, their data is stolen and be threatened to be released, and customers can't get to their infrastructure because there's a denial of service shutting everything down. I mean, talk about being dead in the water.
Wow. Yeah. Unbelievable. What are we seeing? A couple things, and then I want to pivot over to a couple questions we have about R-Evil, which was one of the first in-depth your analysis and your writings on R-Evil were second to none. I mean, it was so well done. It was just amazing. Are we seeing any, like, what's the status of LockBit today? What are the things that they are, I mean, we see them on several different breaches in the news, like just in the regular news, mainstream media, you see the name LockBit coming up. I mean, they're getting regularly, they're branding themselves, right? I don't know if they have matching jackets yet, but they are definitely a brand. And so what are we seeing? What's the like next evolution you can see them going to? Like what, in your opinion, what do you think LockBit 4.0 is going to look like?
So there's only so many features you can build in. But having said that, these guys are very innovative. There's a lot of things, I mean, more than we could fit into this, but there's a lot of things that they've done that they're the first to do, that they developed, that have been very creative ways to conduct their attacks. Some of it from on the inside, meaning what they're doing once they're in a network, others with the ransomware itself. But where I think we're going to is I don't know that's ever going to go completely away, but we're definitely moving to a model that's going to be more focused on stealing data and less on encrypting with ransomware. Think about it. You're less likely to get caught if you're not putting a ransom payload in the environment. And if you just go look back over the past 2 years, the biggest issues or the biggest breaches we've had aren't because a company has their data encrypted. The biggest issues have been, like, let's use Apple as an example. When R-Evil went after them, you know, they were going to release like intellectual property prior to them having their new laptops come out if they didn't pay them. And, you know, so it's just things like that. The intellectual property theft and release, or your customer data being released, has far more of an effect. So it's easier to do, and you're not as likely to get caught if you're not putting, you know, payloads throughout the victim's environment. So I think that's what we're going to move to.
Okay, that makes a lot of sense when you think about it logically. So the extortion element will still be there. The payment will still be there, but it'll be in the hands of the criminal organization. They're not going to spend as much time, theoretically, in the future, locking it over still on the premises or in the possession generally digitally of the actual victim.
Oh, we're starting to see that now. It's just a small percentage. 10% of the attacks I've seen have been just the data extortion. So it's not like it's a mainstream thing yet, but I do. I think that's where we're headed to.
Makes perfect sense.
Yeah. Well, yeah.
So from your research, when we think of our evil, you know, after the Kaseya attack in July 2021, the U.S. government kind of took some action. They had a discussion with Moscow prior to the Ukraine invasion, and then there was that big bust that was very visible. That kind of traditional Russian bust where they break down doors and they throw guys on the ground. It was very dramatic. And then they do that. So many questions there, but first let me step back. Are there any similarities in either the personnel or the methodology? You know, we've touched on a couple of them, but between our evil and Lockbit?
No, you mean today's Lock? I mean, today's our evil, correct? Today's version.
You're right.
Correct.
Yeah.
There's almost none. So whether, you know, those guys that were arrested, our evil went away. Whether they had the right guys or not, that's a different argument. But regardless, you can't argue the operation stopped. And then, you know, the only thing that the new operation has in common is it's using the same infrastructure and they're using our evil payloads. But the persona, the human element, the behavioral pattern, even the TTPs that we use in attacks are all different. You know, so maybe there's a guy or two.
What TTPs are, just because people don't necessarily understand. Yeah, can you explain what those are?
Just in a short summary, that would be, it stands for tactics, techniques, and protocols. But really what it means is the things that we as humans like that we use in an attack. So if I was going to break into your house and I liked to use a crowbar in order to get into.
It's like the MO. It's like the modus operandi in a regular physical criminal attack, right? This person always ties up his victims a certain way or something. Yes, there's like a.
Exactly.
Okay. Interesting.
We can build none of that.
Okay, so
yeah, and that pattern does not exist anymore with a new one, with a new R evil. So, in my opinion, and the level, the volume, the level. I mean, they're not. They're just not what they were. They're not vocal on forums. You know, these guys had such a big ego. There's no way it's the same guy. Just his ego was out of control. I mean, everything. And if he was released by the Russian government and said, "Hey, go back out and do your thing," like he would be out there putting everybody's face. There's no way he would be quiet. And
what online moniker did he use? Was it Zero? What was he known as?
Yeah, well, he used one that was called Unknown. Unknown. And then like Zero, New Day, he actually used just the R Evil moniker itself. There might be one in there I'm not thinking of, but because it changed a handful of times. But yeah, there's those three or four that he used. But Unknown was the biggest. I know that sounds very general, but that was the biggest moniker that he used under the alias and is the most popular that he had used during his
time. Let me ask your thoughts on this. So. With the big takedown and as public as it was when they took down our evil in Russia, some of our contacts over in the European bloc have seen those individuals are now nation state employees. Any thoughts on that?
I think that's a lot. Yeah, I think that's a lot more likely than to believe that they're back doing attacks under the our evil moniker. I think it'd be that's a lot more likely that they're now supporting the Russian government, probably because they don't have a choice, than it is to believe that they just let them go and now they're back with the same site, infrastructure, name, you know, know, business as usual. I don't think that's the case. I think it's much more likely that they're being used as a resource. I have no evidence of that, but just what makes sense, I think that makes far more sense. What we do have evidence of, though, is, like I said, the both attack TTPs or tactics, as well as the human aspect, just don't match our evil with this new activity.
Right.
Right.
Okay.
So let me ask you this before we wrap up. The double cross that happened, the fall of our evil, what were they doing in your research? And for listeners, you might be mind, this might blow your mind, but our evil apparently was double crossing some of its own affiliates that it was working with. And then there is there like an arbitration system and like a courtroom thing where the judge, like I was reading your research and they were saying, well, like in the arbitration system, they made their case for this. I'm like, is there a courtroom where these guys can like, I'm an affiliate. I was breaking into this huge company and my other criminal boss wasn't able to, like, that doesn't exist in, yes. In most criminal organizations. So can you walk us through that?
Yeah. Across the entire ransomware community, there is forums that they use are very well respected, and you don't want to pick off of those. And you put down deposits of money and things like that in order to gain recognition and to get people to trust you and things like that. Well, they have, and it's existed for years, they have an arbitration system, and there's a process where if you feel you were wronged by the criminal, you enter a claim in arbitration, and there is an arbitrator, and they look at all of the evidence, and they hear from both sides, and then they make a decision. And if they decide you have to pay, either they take the funds, if there's funds that have been put up sort of in a pool for verification and instances like this for arbitration, they're either paid from that or you have to pay them and that has to be validated or you get banned from the forum. And It's not just as easy as rejoining and coming in. You have to, you have to gain the experience in order to be trusted, build your name. I mean, there's criminals. It takes a lot to trust another criminal. So it actually works for the most part. People don't want to get banned. Even Lockbit, they did something against the rules and got banned for a week last month. It was just for a week.
It's bad for their business. Yeah. So there is kind of a checks and balances, almost like an honor among thieves, where they have to.
There is.
No. Yeah. So there's a whole system. I just found that interesting. It is something that most business owners and most people that even are studying this are unaware. So I found very interesting. What did our evil do that involved their double cross? What were they doing to their affiliates?
Yeah. So this is in my history of evil white paper. History of Revil, our evil, play on the words, white paper. But yeah, what they did is they actually, and this was originally discovered, the code was discovered by Advanced Intel, but they were building code into their their software or their ransomware and their control panel, in which case when an adversary was having a chat with a victim, an affiliate having a chat with a victim and doing negotiations, the core gang from our evil could cut off that negotiation and switch it so that they were now negotiating with the victim. And it appeared to the affiliate that that victim just disappeared and decided not to pay.
Oh.
And they don't know that it's a different person. The victim, our evil gets paid. They tell and they keep everything instead of having to have a resource.
Wow.
That is unbelievable.
Hey, I've got a quick question that I would love, just some recent whispers in the wind that I've heard. So with the shuttering of Conti, I've talked to a couple of people that said maybe that was a dismantle and disperse operation and all the pieces to the four cardinal points of the compass to be reassembled at a later time. So servers have come back online. Any thoughts on that? I'm not that close to that, but I just wanted to get your input.
That was 100% and well planned and well done exit. When they went after the Costa Rican government the way they did, that was sort of a die by my own sword. technique. You know, there's no doubt in my mind they have a long-term plan. And my guess is it just got too hot and they are taking a step back and they're sort of still facilitating that overhead business. They're just doing it for other ransomware groups. But I 100% believe we will see them again in the future. They're too good at what they did and it's too lucrative.
Yeah, they made a pretty compelling case. It seemed like a pretty compelling case that's probably what that reflects. So what do you see as far as the evolution of ransomware? As we've come like full circle now from ransomware as a service to Lockbit 1.0, 1.2, 2.0, 3.0, you know, potentially other things that it could evolve to. Are there new groups, new affiliates that are using some of these successful tactics and techniques and protocols to start new organization? Like, are there somebody on the horizon that we haven't quite heard about yet? Any input on that?
I mean, you know, a lot of the groups that are popular today came from just that model you spoke of to, you know, include R Evil, you know, like they were once affiliates of someone else. That's how they learned sort of, you know, the ransomware gang. And then they branch out on their own and start their own program. So, yes, that definitely happens. As far as what are coming that are happening today that are relevant, it's hard to say. And the reason it's hard to say is there are so many ransomware groups right now, and there are so many new ones popping up that, you know, until you have time to really go and one, get them to have a track record and experience, and for you to figure out who they are and how they tie to something else, that takes time. So until that happens, it makes it difficult. But also, it's just there's just such a high volume of them. It's difficult. It's difficult to know. So I don't have one on the top of my radar that I can give you an example of.
Okay.
But I, you know, I know because history shows us, you know, Dark Side to Black Matter, and then they went and started doing the development. The Black Matter developers who helped develop Lockbit 3.0, so they're working together. Are Evil. They had a close relationship with Dark Side. I mean, so all these resources, you know, you can just sort of see them go out. But what is different is it used to be a group would go away and that entire group would now move over and rebrand. And that's not what I'm seeing now. Right. Now we're seeing the group goes away and they might go to three different groups.
Oh, there's more of a disbursement. They disperse. Yes.
And that makes attribution difficult when we start to talk about, oh, well, this group used to be that group. It makes it difficult. So we just got to look at it differently that, oh, this resource might have been with that group, but now it's with this group. Right? The ransomware community is so much smaller than what everybody thinks. And a lot of these guys know one another.
That's so amazing. We have a question from one of the viewers, one of the listeners. It's from John Young. He was curious about any information you might have about the inside story about the zero-day attack which damaged the centrifuges that Symantec identified at the Iranian nuclear plant. Do you have any insight in that?
Yes and no. So the team that I worked at Symantec, I was not there yet. The team and my boss were the ones that discovered that at Symantec, and they're the ones written about in all the books and the movies and stuff like that. I worked for the U.S. government at that time, and I worked. I won't be able to talk too much about that.
Right.
But
okay.
There's a about it.
For the listeners, can you walk us through what happened? Yeah. What happened in that event?
So there was. Story. Yeah. So obviously, there were sanctions and things like that. We were telling Iran they could not develop nuclear weapons. Iran was claiming, oh, we have nuclear power plants just for the sake of energy purposes. We knew that wasn't the U.S. believed that wasn't the case. There was at the time, it's validated now. At the time, it was all underground. They had an entire underground facility. Iran did an entire underground facility that they used nuclear weapons, and they were getting close to being able to enrich plutonium. So in that process, you have these big centrifuges. You put the plutonium in, it spins around, separates the molecules, and what you're left with is this enriched version of it, and that's what goes into the development of the nuclear warhead. Okay, so what Allegedly, what happened was the U.S. government teaming up with Israel created malware that actually affected the speed of those centrifuges and would just make them sort of go wacky and spin out of control. And basically what we were doing is significantly damaging and slowing down their progress without killing people. That's what we were doing. So it was a way to significantly slow them down and prevent them pushing that, putting them back, you know, probably 5 years without killing people. But if you see, and this part is from in the movies, like you see the Zero Day movie or in Kim Zetter's book, you know, we believe that that kind of got the Israel part and the U.S. part got a little out of control with who was controlling what with that attack, which is they were doing it too much, which is how they got caught. And it allegedly started by planting USB devices in parking lots near government facilities. And of course, what do you do when you find a USB? Apparently, you plug it into your computer. I saw that.
It works in a nuclear power.
By the Capitol, posted that they found a USB on the ground and if they should plug it into their computer, and they were serious. And I was like, how would people in this day and age do this? No wonder we're getting killed out there. But anyway, yeah, so that's the short of the story. You know, there's other stuff to it, but like I said.
You're telling us that it came to light because people were baited into like plugging in USBs with some sticker on it that had something enticing on it that would make them put it in. I mean, we train organizations all the time on all the different tactics, baiting and things like that. When we get to baiting, they're like, that never happens. That doesn't happen at all. And here at such a high level, it even happened, or allegedly. Yeah. So, yes. Shocking.
Very interesting.
Holy cow.
And we know on their computers, they're obviously disabling USB based security.
Right.
Many corporations do today, you know.
So that's let alone the newer. Hey, John, thank you so much for this discussion.
This was great. You know,
this will absolutely not be the last time we talk. And I will tell you, just absolutely fascinating. We'll have a link in the show notes to The Art of Cyber Warfare where you can get it, and to Analyst One's site and other information, so you can check out John DiMaggio. If you haven't connected with him on LinkedIn, please do so. Really, really insightful, and thank you so much. We really appreciate it. Hi, Cybercrime Junkies. Thanks for listening.
Got a question you want us to address on an episode? Reach out to us at cybercrimejunkies.com. We explore why cybercrime grows daily, how it is funded, productized, and organized, how to protect yourself, and where cybercrime goes to hide. And thanks for being a cybercrime junkie.